Sometime back, I told the story on one of our monthly tapes of a practice that I had visited in Florida that was being run by a husband and wife team. Their production was impressive, to say the least. They were collecting over $150,000 a month between the husband and wife doctors. The thing about the practice visit that really stuck out in my mind was that in spite of the excellent production that was coming out of the practice, there was an inordinate amount of stress and chaos resulting from the overall effort. In fact, I was able to make a list on a legal pad over 3 pages long of the problems that were attributing to this stress, as well as keeping the practice production firmly stuck in place. In the end, I was able to attribute over 90% of the problems that I had listed on my legal pad to the simple fact that the practice was running one staff person short. The tremendous demand being generated by these two highly efficient and personable doctors was what was keeping the production from going down. But it was stressful and plateaued just the same. Doctors often ask me if they have enough staff. It's a natural reaction from anyone who's been listening to one of our audio sets that address practice growth. See, much of the time on those programs is dedicated to determining if the practice is delivering what we call the essence components. That term refers to the essence of what will inspire a patient to refer their friends and family to the practice. For those of you who haven't listened to one of those audio sets recently, one of the key referral essence components is convenience. That means that the patients can get into the practice without any significant delay. Another way of saying they can get in yesterday, according to a patient. Patients use the word convenience to describe the ease of entry to the practice that they seek. The word that we use to describe what we're going to have to do to deliver this convenience is capacity. The key capacity components are treatment time, space and equipment, and staff. When doctors ask if they have enough staff, I have to ask them if they're asking about having enough staff to sustain their current practice or if they're out to increase their production. The question about the proper number of staff for the doctor who isn't seeking immediate growth, that may sound incongruous, but it's not. See, this is a common question for doctors who've just lost a staff person. Maybe the practice is down a little bit, and they're not really sure if they need to replace them. Many of our listeners have already gotten the big idea about staff gestation, and I'm referring to that long period that can pass between the time an unreplaced staff person quits and the resulting downturn in practice production. Sometimes it can be weeks or even months before practice production falls off, especially if the other team members are strong performers. I find that most of our listeners are familiar with our long-standing rule of one staff person at the front for every $30,000 of desired monthly production. I'd like to credit a person I think of as one of my mentors, Ms. Linda Miles, as giving me that statistic. She uses it as a rule of thumb. I've tested it in my practices for years and have come to agree. It's only a rule of thumb, however. For those of you who have attended one of our team training camps, you already know that during the hot seat portion of our program, it's not unusual to see about half the practices that go up to the front of the room violate this 1 to 30,000 rule. Some of the offices have half the recommended number of staff and twice the production of the rest of the hot seat practices. This has led many doctors and their staffs to ask me either why the team that's up there needs so many staff members or how are they able to produce so much with just those three women? That's what I'd like to address on this recording. How it is that so many offices actually need twice as many workers as their neighbors do to produce the same amount or even less practice production. The secret to this mystery lies in a term that we here at Whitehall have used for several years. The term is fractional staff equivalence, or just shortened to staff equivalence. There's an old saying that it's not the amount of soldiers in the fight, but the amount of fight in the soldiers that determines who wins the battle. In other words, it's not the number of bodies you have filling positions in your practice that really counts. It's about how the practice is structured and how effective the workers are at achieving patient compliance and delivering the referral essence components. You see, it's actually possible to have 5 staff members who are less effective than another team that has only 3 or even 2 in some cases. Let me explain. This is what fractional staff equivalents are all about. And when I'm done with this recording, you're going to be better able to judge how many staff you really have working for you. See, it may be more or it may be less than the number of individuals that you now have collecting paychecks each month. When we here at Whitehall talk about staff equivalents, we think in terms of a 6-point practice and employee checklist. It's from this list that we evaluate whether a practice needs more or whether it already has too many employees. I want to go through these one at a time so that you can evaluate your own practice and team members. You may find that when we're through, what's been a mystery to you for years has been finally solved. You may have been either underproductive or unprofitable or even hopelessly plateaued for as long as you can remember. I think it's all about to become clear. The first item on our fractional employee checklist is training. The undertrained team is approaching the crisis point in many of the offices that we serve. See, an undertrained employee can almost be worse than none at all in some cases. Having an employee that continually relies on her teammates to answer questions or perform duties that she should have long ago been competent at can bring down the entire practice. Yeah, I know, you went 8 months without finding anyone, so you hired out of desperation and you didn't get the right person. That's what we're talking about now. See, if you listen to the last month's recording, you know that this is a reflection on the leadership of the practice. Don't let your past difficulties with staff turnover or employee scarcity leave you tentative in your leadership role. Never forget the leadership axiom. If you're in command, make sure that you command. It's easy to feel that since you already have a job, and a big one at that, I'm talking about treating patients, that it's okay to just let staff learn the job on their own as they go. It's not just that you already have a job. Let's face it. It's that you really don't know exactly what it is staff do up there. You know they have to answer the phone, collect money, and make appointments. But you're not sure exactly how to answer all the questions and solve all the problems that can come out of these three simple assignments. Yeah, it's easy to see why we don't want staff or we don't want to see staff for who they are, but instead we want to see them for who they could be. When you consider the tremendous drain on the practice that follows the loss of a veteran team member, it's devastating. We want to believe that we've got the right people. We want to believe it so badly that we don't want to know if we've got someone up there who isn't doing the job. See, that could mean termination, and yes, training and retraining. Some of you may remember the problem we mentioned on an earlier recording about associate doctors. If you have an under-supervised associate, it's not long until the policy and the production of this practice will reflect the associate instead of the owner doctor. It will reflect his motivation, his attitude and focus, and not yours. All of this combines together to determine the production of the practice. As many of you have had to learn the hard way, all you have to do is turn your head for a moment, and your associate is being rude, inappropriate, or downright uninterested in your patients. Yeah, I know, not all associates are like that, just the ones that you've had, right? You see, it's only slightly different with a staff person. Well, let me ask you, if you said absolutely nothing about the way a staff person deals with patients or how she would run the practice, what would happen? That's right, it wouldn't be pretty, would it? Unless you were lucky enough to have highly experienced, super motivated team members, it wouldn't be long before the office closed at 2:30 every day so that everyone could get home in time to start dinner. The undertrained staff member will, when in doubt, solve problems that she encounters in a way that makes sense to her at that time, unless she's had some other guidance. See, the bad news is that, yes, employees have to be given detailed training, training you may not have been interested in gaining for yourself up to this point. But the good news is that if the training is done right and the needs of the practice don't change dramatically, she'll likely continue doing the job just the way she was taught. You see, she really doesn't know any other way now. Later, when you try to unteach her what it took you so long to teach her, you'll see what I'm talking about. Yes, it takes patience to get this done, but it's worth it. One of the problems surrounding the undertrained team quite often is success itself. That's right. You become so busy that there never seems to be enough time to properly train a new staff person. You, the doctor, need to be extremely conscious of how an employee is brought into your practice. It's become so common that I'm beginning to think that it's normal for your other staff to give a new employee the equivalent of a sorority hazing. Yes, your existing staff will purposefully be emotionally harsh on a new employee, partly because they see them as a threat, and in some cases, because they may have been treated the same way when they were hired. Something you've heard me say on previous recordings about this, staff don't just work for a paycheck. They work for the doctor's approval. The thought of a new employee being coddled by the doctor, by the very person that they've served for so long, is repugnant to a veteran staff person. They see your approval as being as scarce as you see your profits being. And yes, of course, that isn't true. You can love and appreciate any number of staff, new and old alike. But remember, they don't see it that way. If you find that some of your great hires are leaving in the first or second month, I believe you're probably suffering from this very problem. Make sure someone is assigned as each new employee's trainer. This prevents them from getting too much conflicting input, as well as holding someone in the practice accountable for their training and emotional survival. Next, make sure you commit the time needed to the training process. Here's where it all seems to break down. It isn't the basic training that usually causes the problem. See, employees pick up the basics rather quickly. It's the finer points that I'm referring to. Yes, an employee can answer the easy questions within a few weeks, things like how to answer the phone. But that doesn't mean that they can solve the problems that can be posed by a difficult patient shopping for low prices, for example. You'll need a training meeting once a week for 1 to 2 hours for new employees for about 3 months. That is 3 months from the time they're hired. She's going to need to see and participate in actual role-playing. At first, just make sure these sessions address the basics. But within a few weeks, turn up the heat. Let her watch as seasoned veterans are given hard questions to answer. You know, the kind that angry, non-committed, immature patients seem to be able to come up with effortlessly. So give her plenty of praise when she gets it right. And when the new person isn't present, make sure that the trainer and everyone else that has assisted in this meeting is also praised for her progress. See, this goes a long way toward giving the trainer, a vested interest in the new person's success and survival. Remember, the veterans see themselves as competing for your approval. If they learn that they can get an extra helping of that approval by making the new person more effective, you'll likely see them really put their back into this training process. So stop a moment now and rate the training of your current team members. If you have someone who's been taught but is still less than 100% effective, use their effectiveness to qualify or quantify their training, not how well they've been trained, but what they can do, not what they've been taught. See, they may have been 100% trained, but only absorbed 50% of what is taught. So you would rate them at 50%. And in effect, you have a half a staff person there. So you might find that right off the bat here in this recording, you've pinpointed a big part of your practice blockage. The next fractional staff equivalent component that I want to address is motivation. I realize that a staff person's motivation can be difficult to measure, especially since everyone's going to display this trait a little bit differently. I'd like to define motivation as the intent to reinvest energy into the pursuit of a goal that's proven worthy in the past, or if previously unproven, based on faith will prove worthy in the future. One of the key words of this definition is energy. See, some employees bring more energy to the table than others. Everything from their personal metabolic rate and personality to their accumulated neuroses are all going to affect how energetic they are. A person that lacks the energy to cross the street to be given a winning lottery ticket will ultimately prove, at best, a fractional staff equivalent in your practice. I sometimes think the word ownership would be better to describe an employee's contribution to a practice. An employee that takes ownership assumes responsibility for all aspects of the practice, not just her job. We tend to think of this as the ultimate in motivation. If the practice is down, she's thinking about what's wrong or what she can do to get back into bonus territory. I've often cited the example of a piece of paper laying on the floor in the staff work area for the better part of a day in a practice I was visiting. The office I'm referring to, when I asked the employees about the paper on the floor, they all turned to me and said that they hadn't dropped it. I contrast this with the story told by a doctor in the Midwest about how she arrived about an hour early to the practice one morning, only to find one of her previously unmotivated employees blowing leaves off the clinic's parking lot with a lawn blower. She said this type of behavior started with his team member right after she got her first big bonus. I realize that nearly everyone listening to this program has the team training camp bonus in place, you know, our hourly bonus. If you've yet to see your team display this ownership behavior that I'm describing, then you either need to work on your employees' list of perceived practice blockages, or you need some employees that are motivated enough to perceive some practice blockages and tell you about them. As those of you who've had a good bonus experience already know, the motivated team benefits all aspects of a practice. Without it, every practice system from scheduling to lost patient reactivation suffers. The sad truth is that you really can't offset a team's lack of motivation by hiring more employees. In other words, you know you need more production, but when you have a bunch of unmotivated people, it seldom works out to just add more of them. so you may be tempted to try, especially at lower production stages, because it could actually appear to work. The problem is that when you try to add more unmotivated people to an already unmotivated team, you get heightened chaos instead of heightened production. When you have unmotivated employees, they try to be careful not to be seen as slacking. This leads the doctor to think that he or she is understaffed because they can't see what's really going on. See, their natural response, or that is the natural response of the doctor, is just to add more employees when it appears that everyone's busy. Maybe some of you have, at some time in the past, worked for a state or local government. When I was in college, I worked for the city of Phoenix on a road crew shoveling gravel. The supervisor would drive around every couple of hours to check our work, to see how we were doing at the job of moving tons of gravel into the various holes that we had to fill. I can tell you that the shoveling rate was about 1/10 of what it was before the orange supervisor's truck was sighted. The veteran slackers taught the new slackers the rules of slackerism. You had to keep the shovel moving at all times. It did not, however, have to move at great speed. The old pros, in fact, were able to make a tiny mound of dirt take hours to disappear. I know that some of you are horrified by this story because it just explained why your team can't seem to get anything done, or why you were the group with 14 employees at the team training camp producing $12,000 a month in collections. Some of you have had great employees in the past who were both bright and hyper-motivated, but when she left the clinic for another job, you began to suspect that all employees of her ability would find your clinic as little more than a way station on the road to bigger and better things. Well, don't be discouraged. Just use her performance as a yardstick to the measurement of a full staff equivalent. If you don't have it, you should get the monthly tape we released some time back called Capacity versus Productivity. On this tape, we discuss the process of doing a time and motion study on your team. This is done so that you can isolate and eliminate slackerism. I know what you're probably thinking. Maybe you have an employee who could be motivated, but you're just not up to doing your part to reach her. Well, that could be the case. Remember, the more unmotivated an employee is, the closer the practice has to be to bonus to inspire her. See, when you have an employee fully intent on a great month, even when you're starting from behind, in other words, it looks hopeless, and she's still on fire, you've got a real gem there. Your average employee isn't going to reach much unless the bonus is imminent to begin with. I guess this leads to the question, what do you do with the ones that you finally determine as being fractional or unmotivated? First, make sure it's not you. That's why we use the report card system. If a doctor has opened him or herself up to staff criticism and corrected his or her behavior in the areas complained of by the staff, you should see this team come to life. If you've done that and they have no good excuse left, you can know that it's time to start upgrading your team at the molecular level. Now, I realize that I've told you that there are 6 components to the staff equivalent concept, but I want to make it clear that this one, the motivational concept, it towers above all of them in importance. That's the one main reason that we use the bullpen concept to strengthen a practice. Without having an extra trained employee, it's just too easy to sit paralyzed by the thought of retraining this underperforming employee's replacement. If you're absolutely sure that you've got your case presentation hitting dead center on the confrontational continuum, your prices and convenience are where they should be, and you're still having to advertise to get patients in the door, well, it's time to look at your team. A motivated team is able to usually fill a practice just through their enthusiasm alone. The highly motivated team will ask every patient, without being prompted by the doctor, if they would like to make an appointment for their husband or their wife. You'll see them handing out your card at the grocery store or dry cleaners when someone asks them where they work. They become the single best referral source of your practice. Those of you who have listened to our patient compliance audio set, you already know that preemptive action is the key to patient compliance and eliminating practice stress. Above all else, the motivated employee thinks ahead of the patient. It's that simple. Do you have a team that spends all their time putting out fires, or worse, coming to you to solve problems that they wouldn't have encountered if they'd been thinking ahead to begin with? If so, then you have a fractional equivalent, not a full employee. Maybe they're a full-time employee, but they're a fractional equivalent just the same. I believe that the larger practices can abide one or maybe two marginally motivated staff. That is, assuming they're not seriously unmotivated, and that there are some highly motivated team members somewhere in the background to offset their lack of enthusiasm. So there it is. you have to have a person worth 1.5 employees to be able to afford one that's worth only 0.5. At the team training camp, it becomes clear that all the super offices have a team made up of what I call plus equivalents. That means that all the employees are worth more than one full equivalent worker. So when you look up at a team on the hot seats and see 5 employees, you're actually looking at 8 or more staff equivalents. So is being an unmotivated, or worse, an unmotivatable employee, a firing offense? I say that if you're the guardian of the bonus, if it's you charged with ensuring that your team gets a bonus, and you can see that a certain employee's fractional contribution to this effort is compromising the bonus of the worthy team members, well then yes, it's a firing offense. After doing everything you can to reach her, and it doesn't work, then replace her. You have to do it for the good of the team. If you fail to act here, you'll ultimately be faced with paying out huge raises against small production increases, or losing your best team members. So stop now and assign an equivalent rating to each of your team members based on motivation. Do you have a few superstars offsetting the performance of several 0.5s or worse, 0.25s? All right, let's look at number 3, ability. When I talk about an employee's ability, I acknowledge that there's a danger in declaring ability a static value, and that under the right circumstances, an employee whose ability may not measure up initially could somehow over time improve those various skill test scores. Unfortunately, our offices aren't geared up to develop an employee's basic skills from one level to another. You could only attempt such an undertaking, I believe, at the cost of the productivity of the entire practice. Well, that said, we have to find out where an employee's skill level stands and make a judgment call about their viability in the practice. I also acknowledge that ability should be classified under 2 headings. First, basic skills. And second, what I call personality to job matching. Those of you who have listened to some of our past recordings may have heard my interview with Nathan Stevens of the Wunderlich Employee Assessment Group. On that recording, you heard Mr. Stevens talk about the 2 tests recommended by his company for use in our professional practices. The first test recommended is a skill test. It's basic math and logic skills. Wunderlich gives what we refer to as cut scores to be used in screening prospective employees. If the interviewee passes the basic skill test, they're then invited to take a more sophisticated and costly to the doctor personality profile to be used in the personality to job matching section. I think this is about as close as you can come to accurately calibrating the staff equivalent component in your practice. In other words, if you have an employee who now scores 50% of the Wunderlich skill test cut score and falls 50% short of the ideal placement zone for the personality to job matching profile, you can know that you would need 2 of these people to get the work done that 1 qualified person would do. I acknowledge, of course, that that is only a theory, but it tends to play out in practice just that way. I do like this analogy, however, because it calls attention to the fractional employee equivalent principle. I say that because you need to acknowledge that having an office full of pleasant, hardworking staff doesn't mean that you've got the various duties covered, even if you meet the 1 person to 30,000 of production ratio that you've heard us talk about at seminars. You see, a whole employee can so easily translate into a fractionally effective worker. I know some of you are now becoming intrigued by this fractional equivalent principle and would like to know if you're adequately staffed. That was the whole idea of this presentation. If you'd like to know the answer to that question from an ability standpoint, you could go back and administer the Wunderlich skill test to your existing employees. Wunderlich does not encourage retrofitted skill testing for the sole purpose of eliminating an existing employee or having that be the basis of eliminating them. They suggest that the test be used on an existing employee for the purpose of better coaching them to improve performance. If you do find that a long-standing and marginally effective employee tests poorly on the Wunderlich skill test, you could use that as the confirmation you've been seeking to move that employee to an easier position and assign her more mentally demanding tasks to another person, someone more qualified. And yes, you could go out of your way to make the job easier using scripts, word-processed mail, or anything you can find that would supplement her limited communication, math, or logic abilities. I think you're starting to get the big idea here. To accurately answer the question, do I have enough staff, requires more than just a headcount and a reference to your monthly production. The next fractional equivalent component I call job fragmentation. Some of you may have heard me refer to this term in relation to the erosion of full-time worker status into a larger number of ineffective part-time workers. The actual term I use to describe this Tower of Babel, confounding of the tongues chaos that follows the exchange of full-time for multiple part-time employees is employee fragmentation. That's not how I'm using this term for the purposes of the recording. I'm not talking about employee fragmentation. I'm talking about job fragmentation. This occurs when an office production grows to the point where a job that was once performed by one employee is now done by two employees or more. The amount of work generated by the ever-increasing number of patients now has grown to the point where it's going to take two employees to accomplish what was formerly done by one. This is job fragmentation. I mention this concept in relation to the fractional employee equivalent principle because it will have a direct bearing on the effective fractional equivalent measurement. Let me explain. So you may have one employee doing a job that encompasses six assignments. Scheduling, reactivation, making financial arrangements, billing insurance companies, missed appointment calls, front desk reception work, six in all. If you divide these into two positions so that each employee has three of these six duties, let's even say you go so far as to divide them in a way that each employee will spend exactly the same amount of time to accomplish their three assignments as the other one will. What you're now looking at will represent two full-time jobs. What I want to point out here is that while the overall effect of the job fragmentation may not reduce the number of hours required to complete the tasks, it will now require less in the way of ability or skill from an employee to be effective. So here's another mystery solved. See, some of the big practices that you see on the hot seats at the team training camp are actually made up of very normal employees who benefit from severe job fragmentation. Some of the larger practices I work with have employees that do absolutely nothing but answer the phone, or in some cases, do nothing but make financial arrangements. I was in a practice several months ago that had four full-time employees that did nothing but make financial arrangements with patients. They didn't have to know anything about how to handle shopper calls or arrange their time so they could make sure every patient got a reminder call before their visit. You see, it's like I always say, bigger is easier when it comes to practice building. It's easy to start out in practice. You just have this one employee. She cares deeply about the practice, and she can slowly increase her pace and her knowledge to keep up with the overall growth of the practice. The problem comes in when you hire staff person number two. She has to get along with number one and find a way to fit into what was once the kingdom of number one. I would say that the 3 to 8 employee range is the toughest stretch of ground you're going to have to cross. After that, you begin to have the noticeable benefit of job fragmentation. You could say that your marginal or fractional employee equivalents almost become whole again when you reach the point of noticeable job fragmentation. What I'm saying is that somebody that might rate a 0.5, that is, they're technically worth a half a staff person, can actually be made whole again when the job gets easier. There's a local grocery store that a lot of people in my neighborhood go to that has several young men there who bag groceries. These young men are mentally challenged. And that's because this compassionate institution has found that you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to remember to put eggs on top of the milk when you're bagging groceries, thus giving these excellent young workers a chance to do something valuable. See, even the most challenging job in the clinic is really only made up of a number of simple tasks. As the job fragments, these simple tasks are gradually spread out to more and more employees. When the complexity's gone, so is the requirement for superhuman skill and focus. We tend to imagine that our clinics will always require that we find the best and brightest to sustain practice growth. That's not been our experience in practice management. Unfortunately, you do have to reach the fragmentation point before you can afford the luxury of being able to hire normal people for your clinic. See, prior to that, you have to find a way to compete with corporate America for the above average employees that are out there. In conclusion to this component, you could say that fragmentation has the potential to swing the fractional equivalent rating back in favor of your existing employees. You could have 8 fractional employees that are as effective as 8 whole employees if the job complexity factor was reduced. The next fractional equivalent component that I want to look at, I call the peak demand factor. See, many of you have heard our thoughts on the importance of exploiting peak demand times during the day. This principle states simply that patients tend to bunch up around certain times of the day. In other words, you can have all the patients you can treat between 3:30 and 6:30 in the afternoon, or between 6:30 in the morning and 9 in the morning. Some doctors have gotten so proficient at this that they manage to keep their clinics growing without the aid of either advertising or referrals. Yeah, I know that sounds strange, but it's true. See, some of them have learned that if you offer what we call hyper-convenience to patients, that is, making it possible for them to get right in, you can tap a limitless wellspring of peak demand time patients. There are some practices that report just the opposite. They may be in a retirement community where people have nothing better to do than drive around in golf carts and sit in your reception room all day. It can be the same in some farming communities where patients come in at a fairly even pace all day long. When you consider that in most practices, however, patients tend to want to bunch up, the employee fractional equivalent factor will now come back into play. For example, if you have 80% of your patient load trying to land during a small window of your daily schedule, your staffing requirements will be different than a practice that experiences a smooth, even patient flow throughout the day. See, on paper, it can be made to look as if you have enough staff to cover the demand. But in reality, in light of this uneven flow, you're short-staffed. The way this all usually plays out in practice is rather tragic. The doctor's failure to respect the peak demands of his or her patients usually results in what appears to be an illogical staffing requirement. The doctor facing this problem will usually fail to add the needed peak demand staff because there would be nothing for them to do during the slow times of the day, so it just doesn't seem logical to add more or better staff. This doctor spends the remainder of his or her career unsuccessfully trying to fill the slow times of the day. All the while, there were patients unable to get in for treatment during the peak demand times. Since patients never seem to want to see us enough to wait in line outside our offices like they do for the opening of the next Lord of the Rings installment, we never seem to fully grasp the cost of failing to provide more peak demand capacity. If you have an unfragmented peak demand time office, you'll need the best staff that your money can buy. Let me repeat that. Unfragmented, meaning we need people that can do complex jobs because they're having to do a lot of different things at one time. Peak demand time means everybody wants to bunch up. So nothing could be more taxing on your team than an unfragmented peak demand time practice. The fractional employee knows that to avoid embarrassment, they're going to have to prevent that swarthy mob that tries to form every afternoon in your reception room from ever getting on the appointment book to begin with. I've lost count of the number of doctors that have told me that their practice doubled during the peak demand times of the day when they changed front desk staff. Often the previous person who occupied that position was unconsciously shielding the practice from being overrun after 4:30 by simply making it hard for patients to schedule. The new person, however, the bonus-driven one, that is, she knows to get them in the door and then figure out how to treat them later. So be on notice. If you're seeing excess demand during the early morning or late afternoon, the profile of your practice is such that better staff are called for. The last and final fractional equivalent component I want to look at, we call the case average factor. You may have heard me talk about case average on previous recordings. This number, case average, is a crude calculation that actually represents nothing in and of itself, but it's an excellent gauge for other performance measurements in the practice. The calculation for arriving at your own case average is as simple as dividing your new patients, that's all new patients to the clinic in a single month, into the total production of that clinic for the month. If you saw 20 new patients last month and you produced $40,000 in collectible services, you would have a $2,000 case average. In a practice that has a high case average, fewer staff are required to produce the same amount of services as one with a lower case average. When I say fewer staff, you could also apply the fewer staff equivalents concept here. I have practices that routinely collect $100,000 a month that need exactly twice as many staff as a practice that will collect $80,000 a month. That's because some of the $100,000 a month practices see over 100 new patients per month, while the $80,000 a month practice may see only 40 new patients per month. So you can see it's more about new patients than it is about production. And yes, this is part of the secret that explains how the superstar practices that occupy the glorious team training camp hot seats are able to produce so much with so few team members. And I know some of you want to ask, do I have a high case average or a low case average, or how do you determine? Typically, based on the mathematical formula that I just gave you, we're looking at a case average of 2,500 per patient as the baseline. That's where we come up with the 1 per 30,000 rule. So let me wrap this presentation up by saying that the 1 per 30,000 rule, that is one staff person at the front desk per $30,000 of production per month, is a rough rule of thumb used to quickly evaluate the staffing needs of a clinic. We all tend to like such quick, simple measurements. This month's recording has been designed to help you see your practice and your staff and what they can do more the way a consultant sees it. When we visit a practice, we're looking at more than just how many staff occupy the seats in the clinic. When I originally laid out this presentation, I considered a total of 12 fractional equivalent components. But when I was done working with the concept, I had to admit that these six were the ones that we place the most weight on when we're asked to evaluate the staff requirements of a clinic. All right, let's do a quick overview so that you can put all the variables to consider when evaluating your clinic staffing needs into one formula. I think it's easiest to look at it in terms of extremes. First of all, let's look at the nightmare scenario. Remember, there were six components: training, motivation, ability, job fragmentation, peak demand patterns of the clinic, and case average. Here's the worst: a clinic that has no time for training, so all the staff are fractionally trained. Their motivation is poor because they don't believe in the bonus, don't understand the bonus, and have not taken to it. The Wunderlich score tests your employees as having very little in the way of ability. Job fragmentation is non-existent. What that means is that you have a few people doing a lot of different jobs, which requires more skill, talent, and focus. Number five, peak demand pattern of the clinic is such that patients want to bunch up all at one time during the day. And six, case average, you have a very low case average, meaning you produce very little per patient, so you're going to be processing a lot of people, which determines how much work your staff have to do, for very little production. That would be the nightmare. What that would mean is, if we looked out at your practice, all the seats might be full theoretically, but the odds are pretty good you've got about half the staff you really need to do the job. Let's flip this around. You have a highly trained team, hyper-motivated, tremendous ability. The jobs have fragmented to the point people only have one or two things to worry about. The peak demand pattern of the clinic is such that patients flow in evenly during the day, or at least they don't bunch up all at once. And case average, you produce quite a bit per patient. This was the dream scenario. We could take a practice producing, $100,000 a month, and it would need half as many staff to do the job, or even less than the other scenario that I just described. I would suggest that you look at the one staff person at the front desk per $30,000 of production rule more as a starting point. You can then add and subtract from this requirement based on these six evaluators that we've outlined. Remember, it's not about size where staff numbers are concerned. It's about your clinic's productive patterns and the individual effectiveness of your team members.